So I'm going to talk about a problem that doesn't really exist in the public imagination, or however you want to call it, yet. And I'm going to claim that it is relevant to everybody. One could say that it is not, because most people obviously don't seem to care much about the aesthetics of anything. And I must admit that I'm kind of a, let's say, optics nerd. I obsess about colors and forms and designs all the time. So I might be a bit biased at this point. But I'll suggest that at least some of the stress of city dwellers has to do with aesthetics. And they might not really care, or they might not know that they care, but they are still annoyed. So considering how much of Earth population lives in urban areas today, and how this portion is only getting bigger, that makes any idea as to how to make living in a city more pleasurable really fucking important. I'm talking about the city here because she is a point where the last illusion of living in a natural environment has to crash. The city is where it becomes obvious that our surroundings, our living environment, are made, not given. They are made up of all the artifacts that we use in our daily lives. Thus, design cannot claim anymore to be just decoration. Under these circumstances, it has a responsibility far beyond make something look nice, and a potential way more exciting than that. To me, it seems extraordinarily cruel that in a world that is literally made by man, like no world we've lived in before, a full, fascinating, satisfying sensory experience, just feeling and seeing and listening stuff that, well, looks and sounds and feels good, is a privilege, and more people live under even uglier conditions than ever before. I'm going to propose a new interpretation of that classic industrial design quote, form follows function. Form follows function is a simplification. Form is a function. Form is the function of something that makes it not just usable, but using it a pleasure. Considering this, most current artifacts are quite dysfunctional. Using nature as a model, I'm going to look at certain aspects of design that please our senses, that are often neglected, and argue that repetitive strain injury, that is pain or damage resulting from the repeated use of some device or other, is a completely unnecessary design flaw. I will try to point out the role of choice and control over your own surroundings to feel comfortable, and how this conflicts with the idea of really designing our maidscape to be pleasurable for everybody. I'm going to end with some completely unrealistic wishes I'd still like to see realized in my lifetime. So obviously, I'm using design in a broader sense than is usually done, and I'm doing so mostly because I didn't find a better word for now. Maybe someone of you can come up with something that, yeah, is doesn't seem to be restricted just to how something looks, but everything that can be formed, that can be consciously chosen about something that we make. So the more artificial our surroundings become, the bigger are both our need and our options to make them pleasurable, to form them according to our liking, as exciting or beautiful or soothing we want to. Simply because everything we make, everything we do, we could do differently, we could make differently. We need to do it because nobody else will do it for us. Obviously, nature isn't going to show up to build our houses, and we cannot count just on the rain to fall and paint everything, or just our gadgets to grow up like weeds. Although the city sometimes seems to evolve on its own, it is still made. It might be made by a lot of uncoordinated people, but they're still people and they still make decisions, and they could talk to each other and make these decisions together. Most things in it are not a given in the city, but a chosen. The more choice people have, that is, nowadays, the more money they have, the better their products tend to look, feel, smell, taste, sound, and hence the privilege of actually having enjoyable things around you. But this having an enjoyable environment could just as well be seen as a basic requirement of human life, health, and well-being, and would then fall more into the realm of politics than fashion, for example. Well, I've chosen nature as a model because its looks and some of its sounds please me in ways that artifacts don't yet. When I'm talking about beauty and pleasure, what I mean is that something suits our sensory apparatus that is neither boring nor too much. I believe that this has very little to do with individual taste, but also that this is a subject so far, at least to my knowledge, under-researched. I turn to nature as an example because I assume that our sensory apparatus is most attuned to what we can find in nature in general. There's no reason why cities should be any less beautiful than the countryside if we can decide how the city is made. I'm not talking about affirming the negative here, about liking something because you have just looked at it so often for so long, or calling something nice because it is so ugly it's already cute again. That's completely not the point. We can all just start to like something because, like the look or feel of something because we like the thing or the function that thing fulfills, but that's not really what feeling or looking good is. So in the following, I'm using certain properties found in many or most natural objects as a model for design. This time not because nature is so efficient, but rather because I assume, landscape just over here as my first slide, because it sums up pretty much about these properties of natural objects or scapes. It's just, there's almost no right angle in it. It has many nuances and shades, and except for the water, it's not straight in any way. I cannot prove that this is true for everybody, that they find this kind of soothing or just pleasurable. I haven't looked up the science. I will mostly argue from personal experience. The properties we'll be talking about are mostly visual, but that has not to do with that it couldn't be, what I'm saying couldn't be applied to other senses as well. It's just that the examples I could think of are mostly from the visual realm. There's one example of somebody else who has thought along similar lines for sound. And I'm going to read a little quote from this. It's Murray Schafer from in a book called Hearing History, which is nice and, as I said, makes a similar point. Noise pollution results when man does not listen carefully. Noises are the sounds we have learned to ignore. Noise pollution today is being resisted by noise abatement. This is a negative approach. We must seek a way to make environmental acoustics a positive study program. Which sounds do you want to preserve, encourage, multiply? When we know this, the boring or destructive sounds will be conspicuous enough and we will know why we must eliminate them. Only a total appreciation of the acoustic environment can give us the resources for improving the orchestration of the world soundscape. For many years, I have been fighting once a on. Well, what he's saying about sound, that we have to make it a positive study program and have to be aware of which sounds we want to preserve, encourage, multiply, of course, can be seen in much more general terms as which kind of sense impressions we want to encourage, multiply, and preserve, and which ones we don't want. Yeah. So natural objects looked at, they have form, texture, color, and usually these forms are of a particular kind. They're not rectangular. The texture, it's just not smooth and even, but there's some more to it. There's something, yeah, we'll get into that some detail. And the color, it's not really bright. It's not a pure color, and it's usually not a pure gray either. It's somewhere in between. It's a shade, it is mixed. It's not uniform. And another thing is that natural objects, they decay over time. They change. And you can see and feel and smell that too. The looks are often bound to their state of decay or otherwise. That is, they carry very nuanced information that most of us can interpret without having to think about it. None of these characteristics are shared by most modern artifacts. So the thing about texture, for example, is there's hardly anything in nature that is completely smooth, or even some minerals excluded, and maybe cover of the water. And if it is, it is usually round, or its form is of such kind that produces tension to make a surface even. So it comes from what thing is and what it does, if it is even in any way, and not just because that's how surfaces are used to be or are supposed to be. Yeah, one example. Now, the avoidance of right angles and obvious rectangular corners, of course, is a classic issue of 60s, 70s design, and the round corners are a cornerstone of Apple's success, at least superficially. But textures are mostly missing from just any industrially produced thing. At least those I have in my home. Of course, there are exceptions and stuff, but and of course, stuff made of natural materials like wood or some fabrics also has a very prominent and obvious texture. If you look around in a city, it's usually just the same. Everything is just as smooth as can be, sometimes excluding mostly boring surface effects in buildings. But even there, they are rare. Texture is interesting because it appeals both to sight and touch and changes very much with the lighting. Now, the textures I can find, from Raufasertapete to those sometimes used on buildings, aren't very interesting because basically because they are still way too even. The texture of a tree trunk or leaf or human skin or anything changes over the whole surface. It is nowhere exactly the same as somewhere else. And it tells us something. It communicates with and follows the form of the object it covers, as well as showing traces of what it has experienced, been through, who has touched it, how the weather has been during the last years, or how somebody has looked a lot in his or her life. This kind of trace is systematically avoided in industrial design and often simply wished away and ignored in building. It is something to be hidden, and if it does occur, it looks quite shitty. It's basically the look of a building that should have been repainted like 20 years ago, and you just see all the dirt and stuff, and it just doesn't look right. That's one of the reasons why I want decay designers. Meaningful textures and nuances can be the effects of the use of an object itself. They don't have to be imposed, yet they can still look good. One example of where it does look good, I'm sorry, I don't have a picture up, is in very old books. I once went to a library where obviously the librarians didn't care or didn't have the means to care much about their old books, and some of those books were over 100 years old, and you could see them fall apart. and they had and the point was they looked beautiful. They sometimes the covers came up off and you could see what was below them and what the bookbinder had used to stabilize them, and sometimes there were other texts hidden in the covers of those decaying books. And it was just really, really, really beautiful, and that's quite different from, for example, how an old, I don't know, an old monitor looks when it's discarded. It's just, there's something, there's a difference here, and I think this difference could be analyzed and could be used as a way to make new artifacts decay in a beautiful way. And colors. As I said, the colors we use, and therefore most of what we see every day in artificial surroundings, use only a very limited and mostly grayish scale of what we can actually see and what can be found in nature. Simply put, the nuances are lacking, and it's no accident that cities, even where they consciously try to counteract it, look gray. No? 60s design? Here, this is one example from a Plattenbau in Berlin, where they obviously have tried to make this really ugly building somehow more livable by just putting some color on it, and it really doesn't help a lot at all. I've looked at this quite often, and I'm always like, my God, they tried, and it still just looks so shitty. It's almost as if they try to prove that even if they attempt to make something look good, that it's of no use anyway. The amount of choice in industrial colors we have today wouldn't change that, even if Hundertwasser's window rights were put into practice. Hundertwasser's window rights will be explained a bit later. On this level, just about any display technology today in use is impoverished compared to an amateur oil painting. Now, obviously, I have to explain this a bit more. I've taken this from a book of the late Gerrit Helwig, that's written about, in German, it's called Farbe ist selbstverständlich. And he looked at the way we perceive color and produce color if we produce artificial paint, for example. And one of his points was that we can see more colors in the impure spectrum than in the pure colors. The rainbow is really quite small, and everything that we see outside of the rainbow, where we see a lot more, is just kind of dirtyish colors. And the way these colors are understood, there are two ways. One can be seen that you take one of the primary colors and you mix it with its complementary color, and then you get a more or less dirtyish color, and if you do it right, it should be gray. And another is that you just don't use this complementary color, but you use gray from the beginning. And the theory, the old theory, is that the effect should be the same. But apparently it's not. And what you can see in an oil painting, even in a bad one, is that for all these shades, there are pigments used and they're original colors. And if you use modern print or a display like this one, it's all, the colors are produced through adding gray, mostly. So it all looks more or less gray, and it looks much more grayish than it has to be. He also claims that because we can make more of the pure colors than in older centuries, and we like the bright and shiny pure colors best, we don't notice all the shades that are missing because we don't really consciously care about them. Yeah. this is, so there's something lost with colors. There's something that could be brought back. And obviously I don't have a good way to demonstrate this point. I could not bring an oil painting and show it to everybody so you could actually see it from behind there. But if you take a bit of time, for example, to just play around with some watercolors at home and try to mix them and then look what comes out of it. And then you do the same in a digital color picker or Photoshop or something, you will notice that there is a very striking difference between the kinds of colors that you can produce in both ways. And I don't think that this grayish scale has to be used. There are reasons it's more comfortable, it's more practical for some, but if there was an effort made to get the shades back, it would be possible. It cannot be done. So these looks, they don't need to be empty. They don't need just to look good. They can look good in ways that tell me something about the object that looks or feels. Beauty that tells me something about its object conveys more pleasure than the beautiful surface that just hides something ugly. Sense perception doesn't have to be mere aesthetics, but connects to thinking and feeling. It can tell us stuff. And obviously, the main purpose of sense perception is to tell us stuff. Now, I get a kind of crude example of that, mostly a comparison from an apple and what its color and texture tells us, and an iMac and what it could tell us. Now, not this image of an apple itself, but if you have a real apple before you, its color and texture tell you something about its taste, its ripeness, and potential damage, probably if you like it, how long it has been lying there, and if it's been moved around or not, so you can see the little, the parts where it's been pushed or hit or something. And of course, there's not really something like that in an iMac. And it's not what an iMac surface should tell me. I mean, I don't want to eat it. And of course, it's not decaying in the same way that an apple does. So, but what it could do is could replace all those little lights and blink thingies, alarm sounds, etc. Could show its workload, temperature, how long I've been working without a pause, how much space is left on its hard drive, or how long it hasn't been backed up. It could reflect, could reflect how often I use it. It could regulate itself according to my patterns of use, both of mind and body aspects. Stuff that I don't use could be disappearing. The keyboard could adapt to the size of my hands. Everything could adapt to its surroundings. How often it has recently crashed or frozen could also be completely different. One of the points is that the distinction between display and hull could be blurred. Now, when I say the surface could tell that to me through colors and textures, I don't mean obvious stuff like signs and symbols and clearly distinct forms. I mean more just shades that I pick up without really thinking about it. Another example could be not the iMac, but a simple object like a cup. It could become used to the shape of my hand, which a lot of, for example, when you use a lot of wood in building or somewhere, it's the famous example of the wooden stairs, where you just see how often people have tripped on them in the last decades or something because they changed their form. I think of stuff that works a bit quicker than that, but in a similar direction. The cup could reflect the temperature of the beverage in it, its caffeine content, how often I use it. Actually, I'm dreaming about the day when all the stuff that I haven't touched for a long while just turns a subtly different shade that still looks good, but discreetly tells me that I really don't need it anymore and could discard it. Would make tidying my room so much easier. Well, but this whole sense perception thing, there's not just the perception of stuff that is outside of us that we see or can touch, but also the perception of what happens to our own bodies when we use it. I think that repetitive strain injury is a design flaw, and one that in the age of the Wii can be erased. Any gadget that makes you hurt does something wrong. We are not just brains, and thinking could be much more pleasure if our gadgets took that into account. So I don't want my body to be bored while my mind is thinking. I like to think and move somehow at the same time, like playing an instrument or drawing. And this is certainly not just me, because if you look at people, most of them will move around a bit while they think about stuff. They will look out the window and they will change their posture, and they think they will make strange movements with their hands. And I think that this is only natural, and that it's kind of an impoverished form of thinking with your body that would just feel better. I don't think that writing has to be a hands-only activity, and I don't know anyone who does not move while thinking. For the production of stuff, that means that things my body can do should be considered, but mostly what it likes to do. Repetitive strain injury is a design problem because the tools we use don't offer enough variety in movement in using them. Maybe there could be ways to type that work more like dancing, but nobody has thought of them yet because the typewriter model is so ingrained in our imagination. The keyboards whose use can injure us are not really designed to be used by humans. They are variations on the printing press, more or less, even so-called ergonomic ones. With the means of modern technology, no thing in the world has of necessity to produce repetitive strain injury. With musical instruments, strain followed from the necessities of their use. But with most human to digital interfaces, there's rarely such a real functional necessity for a monotonous movement. Repetitive strain injury could be completely abolished by design. Of course, all this has come much closer with the Wii, and part of it could be described as the Wiiification of our world, but the Wii is still tied to a screen. Think Wii/theremin, that old electronic instrument that is controlled by the movement of your hands in space around without actually having to touch it, slash color organ, slash holodeck, slash rich oil painting with cushy fur, maybe like a pet or something. Just something that feels good. Everything made should and could be made to the best use of human sense perception and bodily ability. Best use in this context means avoiding suffering and boredom while enhancing pleasure and well-being. It doesn't mean stretching our capabilities so using stuff becomes a sport that leaves more and more people behind, but rather finding out where the sweet spot of usability really lies and remaining adjustable to individual preferences and abilities. I want the most pleasing life I can have, just like anyone. But that means that everything in it, everything I do, like sleep, eat, walk, sit, shit, read, click, watch, listen, talk, write, learn, and all the other stuff, can have its own beauty and its own pleasure, and a very, not just intellectual pleasure, but be enjoyable to me as a bodily being. And all these interactions and all those things that I use for doing this stuff They actually form my living environment. Yeah, and just because I like to write does not mean I want to sit still all day in front of a screen. Mathematicians have bodies too. There is a very obvious example where the classical form follows function approach doesn't get very far. I'm thinking about urban housing. Or rather, I had an example in mind where, which I, sorry, I can't show you, but Buckminster Fuller, for example, designed several models for whole cities of different sizes, and some of the human needs that he took into account were privacy and sunlight. But not just as in a private flat of myself, for myself with a window or two, but rather as the residential area of one of these design cities was on the outer side of a ring. This had the effect that everybody looked out on the landscape and nobody into his neighbor's apartment. That way, a lot of apartments could be stacked together without producing a feeling of crowdedness, and everybody had a lot of daylight. Now, I'm not supposing that Fuller's designs be taken as the best way to form cityscapes, because what he didn't take into account was individual choice, and people seem to feel more comfy the more control they have over their environment, or at least those parts of it where they regularly spend a lot of time. Certainly I do. Think workspaces, think your home. The topic of choice in urban living has cropped up before in the work of Friedensreich Hundertwasser, in what he called Fensterrecht. I mentioned it before. Fensterrecht is the right to paint the facade of the house you're living in as far as you can reach from the windows of your own apartment. But there are obvious problems here, because even if this is my apartment and my window and I just paint it as far as I can reach, it's still you who have to look at it. So when forming the cityscape, making decisions how it has to look as a whole is the issue, this thing with individual choice and general choice becomes very... It's something that has to be decided, that has to be talked about, that has to be discussed. And it's not really obvious how that could be done. Another example of this difference between individual choice and what's probably best for, let's say, all of us taken together are ringtones. They seem to use the same frequency as babies, at least as I think, with high tones that we all notice immediately because they seem to say, oh, I'm important. And this is, of course, perfect for the person whose mobile is ringing because he or she will notice it immediately, but it also means that everybody else is stressed out all the time, basically. The simple use of the oral channel in communicating calls is bound to stress us out because we cannot close our ears. This makes sense for the individual who is being called in order not to miss the call, but seems like a terrible mistake considered its effect on everybody else and thus its impact on the form of our environment as a whole. There could well be a way to alert the individual without stressing everybody else that hasn't been thought of yet, or that wasn't profitable enough, because this line of thinking is uncommon today. Just think of vibrating or blinking or color-changing jewelry, like finger rings that could tell us who's calling, or completely different stuff that I couldn't imagine either. Which is just another way of saying that what might be called composite design, that is, what connects us all, And individual choice should be exercised and designed as freedom everywhere. Its borders lie where the exercise of my freedom impinges on yours. I don't think these borders are clearly defined today, and I don't think they are easy to draw, but I also think that it is important that a working consensus be reached about them. I also think that most architectural regulations, which is an area where something similar to what I'm talking about, or something that could be perceived as something similar, is already enacted, they get it completely wrong, because they make sure everything stays within the same bounds, like a lot of colors that cannot be used without a permission or that cannot be used at all, and buildings have to have a certain height, and this all makes them look more alike, but maybe what we're lacking, what we need, isn't to make them all look alike, but more to prescribe a minimum amount of variation, of change. To say that this new building has to use a different color than the buildings beside it. That maybe not every story, every window is allowed to have the same form. Things like that. I also think that these are essentially political questions that can hardly be solved under current conditions. I think that today, both the common good and the individual choice in its full range are grossly underrepresented, and that rather, we're in a state of non-choice, in which decisions like this are made by the famous invisible hand of the market, which has an extremely bad taste. This was the main meat of what I had to say. And I tried to come up with more positive descriptions of what I want. And they are all kind of unrealistic and abstract and strange and obviously in a very early stage of just trying to think outside of the boxes in which I usually think. So I would like to have this place that can actually use the full range of colors that an oil painting can use. And this place where I can't count the pixels with my bare eyes, or that aren't pixelated at all. I could maybe feel my way through a lively discussion thread on the internet, literally. Technology is capable of more than just copying reality. Video calls aren't the end of it. It's not about rebuilding something we already have, like there are some attempts like this one, which looks nice, but this is just trying to fit new technology into an old model of what nice design looks like, and I don't think it's really a good way to go. Which doesn't say that I wouldn't like to have this, but, well. So we're used to a lot of abstraction and distortion in our use of media and things, but we're not used to really connecting them to all our senses and to design them in the way that is thoroughly pleasurable for our whole body. And the better our extensions take care of our senses, and I think of all the gadgets we use as different kinds of extensions of ourselves, like, for example, glasses, and that we already are cyborgs in this way. But that being a cyborg will be much more fun if these extensions we use anyway can actually work with all the complexities and nuances of our senses. Yeah, think of the plasticity of the brain, which just means that whatever you bombard the brain with, it will try to make sense of it, and it's really good at. So if you change the kind of just sense perception it gets, it will usually find a way to find out what it means. if it means anything. If it doesn't mean anything, this whole possibility just goes to crap. So think of the plasticity of the brain as something that can handle a lot of really supple information well, and you will be able to make devices that are more fun and feel more natural to use. And again, decay designers, of course. Now, what it boils down to is that there is a world where things, or just the world itself, because as I said, most of the world we live in is something we made ourselves. It could be much more pleasurable than it is now, because in that world, things would adapt to me instead of the other way around. Yeah, this is the end. Questions, comments? Yeah? No, sorry. All things that I could come up with would be stuff that you make yourself, like handcrafted stuff, but that's not really the point. I mean, you can use a lot of natural materials and get effects that are very pleasing to the senses and doing stuff yourself or buying really important, I don't know, furniture or things, but the point would be to have maybe plastics or, mostly plastics, of course, that just feel and look as good as wood or some other natural material, and I don't know if that exists yet. I'm sorry. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yeah, biotechnology is a really good point. No, this is. It might be very much more easy for, let's say, production processes that use living organisms to produce the kind of, for example, texture that isn't everywhere exactly the same as somewhere else than for conventional means of production. That could be a big thing with biotechnology. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What would we build something that looks nice when it decays if we don't even know if it looks nice if it stayed new? They're exactly the same, probably wouldn't like it in 20 years because the design is way outdated. So we can hardly predict how a decaying object would be. What would be the perfect decaying object in 20 years? Probably our
friend. Yeah. Okay, you're referring to like how fashion changes and how tastes change, and so if something that was produced 20 years ago, it looks shitty today, not because it has decayed, but just because the taste has changed, and how that should be different for decay. Well, I tried not really to talk about the specifics of design that change with fashion, but more how our senses work. So. If my feeling at this point is right, then there are aspects of design that are just not dependent on fashion, and that would, of course, be relevant for decay too. So, for example, maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, there were straight, sharp, pointy edges. And Vogue. And today it's all this apple round edges thing. Now, that's an obvious change of taste that doesn't touch the underlying character of these objects at all. They're still using the same kinds of colors, and they're both probably have a similar smooth surface, and they're all at their core built in right angles. And if there are things that are pleasing to our senses independently of fashion, then of course they can be used in decay design that has to hold up in 20 years too. Another hint that this might be so is of course the history of art and architecture, where you can still find things beautiful that were built and made more than 100 or 200 or thousands of years ago. So there seems to be some continuity in human aesthetic feelings and intuitions. This is my hope, yeah.
Actually, as we're evolving and like having these rather new impressions of like city and artificial buildings and stuff around us, aren't we like naturally evolving to like go away from this like nature, nice fluffy stuff? So because like fashion seems to like point to a direction where we sort of get more device like ourselves, so like a robotic version of ourselves, like using like stuff that's not really necessary, like in fashion tending towards like this aging robot, whatever shiny surface ourselves. Because like people aren't really, we're looking for symmetry in faces. We like it better with like asymmetrical stuff, and like bodily hair is not really important. Fashion cars and stuff. So it's all going smooth and like apple-like in a way. It's not really fast, but maybe humans have adapted to the things we build around us. So the this ugly building might be like a future reference point for what is considered beautiful even in our own bodies or nature.
Yeah.
This is the new nature in a way, isn't it?
Well, I'm just trying to repeat the questions for the video. But I think your main point was that maybe we are adapting to our new environments, and therefore this whole question becomes obsolete. And I think the thing is that our sense perception changes way more slowly than our environment does, and that I could see that with a lot more of biotechnology and genetics and I don't know what, we would come to that point where we actually find this stuff that now looks rather boring better and more interesting than the old stuff. But I think I just really like it much better, and I think it's even more realistic to, well, as I said, make our environment adapt to us and not adapt ourselves to our environment. In this case, in which we make our environment ourselves. But yeah, future will tell. Yeah, I think there's time for another one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're somehow seeking for like the aura of things even more, like in Benjamin's sense.
No.
Because you
oh yes.
Your idea to be like an artifact in a way which does have an aura which is of course different, because you wouldn't tell your iMac from someone else's iMac because they're all the same, but in a way what's the quality of this like natural feeling? Isn't this like the aura?
This I hadn't thought about this at all before, but it's very much like the aura. It's very much about making even an industrially produced thing somehow individualized through its history or through its use, and so that when my iMac would reflect how I use it and where I put it, of course that would make it more like a thing with an aura, like Benjamin said, and yeah, you're completely right.
I was just not thinking of it because of what put it into my talk that it didn't really fit, so. No, it's much later.
Yeah, so I think it would. could be a good time to just call it off now. There's nothing urgent left over anymore. Okay, fine. Okay.